Welcome to Inside Personal Growth Podcast. Deep dive with us as we unlock the secrets to personal development, empowering you to thrive. Here, growth isn't just a goal, it's a journey. Tune in, transform, and take your life to the next level by listening to just one of our podcasts. Welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of Inside Personal Growth. And I got a lot of all my listeners know, sometimes podcasters have a faux pas. I recorded this podcast once before, and Daniel and I are doing it again because of my fault, hitting the record buttons. But I have Daniel Aronson on from New York joining us, and we're going to be speaking about his new book, The Value of Values, How Leaders Can Grow Their Businesses and Enhance Their Careers by Doing the Right Things. Good day to you, Daniel. How are you doing today?
Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to see you, and sorry for actually having to do this again, but you know what? It's always better the second time, so we'll make sure that we get it right this time. I'm gonna let my listeners know a little bit about you. Daniel's a founder of Valuetus, V-A-L-U-T-U-S. You can actually get to his website at valuetus.com to learn more about the software that he has, about how he works with people with values. The company specializes in creating value through sustainable and responsibility. He's the creator of the Value of Values model and the author of this book, which is an MIT Press 2024. He's helped leading companies identify and quantify over $2 billion in sustainable driven business value. And I think that's the biggest thing here, is how Daniel helps companies identify how value plays such an important role in actually improving profitability of the company as well. He coined the term submerged value, which we're going to be talking about. And as I said, he's also the creator of Impact Science, True Plastic Impact, Materiality Science, and Customer Science. He's guest lectured at Harvard Business School and MIT Sloan Sustainability Lab, and has written or been featured in over 100 articles and publications, and as an executive in residence at NYU's Stern School of Business. He holds an MBA from MIT Sloan Business of Management and a BA with high honors from UC Berkeley. But he now lives in New York City, not in Berkeley anymore. Right. Well, that must have been a good time in Berkeley.
It was a good time. Every winter, I wonder why I left on occasion, why I left the West Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Well, Berkeley is a city filled with people who want to also make a change. And they're allowing the world to allow themselves to be seen to do that. So in UC Berkeley, it's kind of known for its protests and rioters and people. They don't riot. They're usually very peaceful. But at the same time, they have something they want to be heard. So I think it's a great school for that. If you're going to send your kids to UC Berkeley, be assured that they're going to get a phenomenal educational, but they're also going to expand their consciousness gravely. So it's a good thing.
It was a little bit of a different experience from MIT, I'll tell you that.
Yes, that is for certain. That's for certain. Well, look, you know, I want to start out. Your book challenges the misconception that acting on values lowers profits. Yeah. That's old school, though, for businesses. Because we're talking more about collaboration here. We're talking about identifying this. We're not talking about looking at people as human capital. You know, it's like, yes, that is a term that's used. But can you elaborate on why this belief persists among business leaders? And what inspired you to debunk the myth of what you're calling the value of values?
I think the reason that it mostly persists is because people don't see all the ways that acting on values creates business value. And that's what I call submerged value. And submerged value is typically 4 to 10 times as much as what they see. And if you see something lying around and you think, yeah, that's like a $10 bill, you're going to work a lot less hard to pick it up than if you think it's $100. And that's the problem, is that people don't see how much it's really worth. And the reason that I wrote the book is two reasons, right? One is that businesses and the world are both worse off every minute that this misperception of how valuable values are persists. And the second is that people want to make a difference. Companies often want to make a difference, but they believe they can't afford to. And it turns out that's exactly backwards.
Well, and I want to echo what you're saying because there's been a lot of discussion lately in my world around values and purposely. I just did an interview called the Chief Leadership Officer and the importance of purpose in a business and values in a business. And I want you to talk a little bit more about submerged value. You know, submerged means that it's sinking. You don't see it. And like you said, people need to see it to actually believe it. But your company allows people to see it through measurement, through measuring something. I think it's always been said you can't change something you don't measure, right? Could you explain this term? Maybe a little bit more in depth and how it relates to the hidden benefits of some initiatives like combating climate change or fostering or the change or fostering inclusive work environments. I had a lady that was just on yesterday from Bon Appetit Management wrote a book, You Can't Serve Manure at Lunchtime. Now it sounded pretty interesting, but the reality is that most restaurateurs weren't looking at the values of the kind of foods they were putting out or the sustainability, and they weren't buying things locally. And what happened is Bon Appetit, the owner got down, and this is a great story, on the pig farmers for the manure. And the manure that's caused from that and what's actually happening in counties in Virginia and other places with relation to the pollution associated with it. We also got into a conversation, and this goes along with values. State of California passed Proposition 2 in January of this year, which was all around the how and what kind of pork products are being served in restaurants. Now, we're a pretty progressive state. And her comment to me was, after that legislation passed, and I think this is interesting around values. She said, you didn't find any restaurants not being able to put bacon on the hamburgers, right? It's how that bacon was accessed, right? How those animals were treated. That's all around values.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that people, I think that people realize is that people don't realize, excuse me, is that values help with the how. The what, of course, that you have to satisfy the customer. You have to operate well. You have to protect yourself against risks, and you have to attract and keep the right employees. But values help in all those areas with the how. We actually call those four areas core: customers, operations, risk, and employees. And if you look at what's available, you get all these questions that seem so clear. Like, who wouldn't want an extra 15, 30, or percent more customer preference, right? Who wouldn't want a 4 times or 5 times greater chance of being an innovation leader in their operations? Who wouldn't want to better respond to risks and disruptions when they happen? And who wouldn't want 50% better retention and engagement, according to some research from last year, for employees, right? And I mean, who wouldn't want these things? And values are part of that how, right? Like you're saying, you still have to deliver the food that the customer ordered, but how do you deliver it? And how do you make money delivering it? That's where values come in.
What do you think? Why do you think that values have taken the back seat of the bus, and are basically just riding along versus CEOs pushing profits, productivity in the front seat of the bus? Now, I do realize they have stakeholders and stockholders that they've got to report to. And most of these big companies, and not even the big companies, small companies too, you're an entrepreneur. But why is it that the mindset has been so against bringing this to the front of the bus to be recognized as an important profit center because they haven't. Now, your company helps them measure it, so it should actually now be quite a bit more valuable because they can measure it. So, why has it always been shifted to the rear of the bus?
You know, that's a good question. And I have a couple of reasons why I think it's the case. But just to put an exclamation point on the point you made, I've been working on this for over 25 years. And in that time, show me the value, show me the business case, show me the money has been one of the top problems and barriers that people have. This was true a quarter century ago. And when IBM did their CEO survey a couple of years ago, they found the number one barrier for CEO action was ROI. And when KPMG did their survey just a couple of months ago, they found the number one barrier to sustainability action was a combination of capacity and ROI. And of course, if you can show ROI, you can get more capacity. That's kind of the history, right? The history is that this has been a problem. And the question you're asking is why? I think that's a good question. I got two reasons. One is that people often kind of split the topic of work from the topic of personal. And as a result, they think something that matters to me as a person can't also matter to my business. Now, that doesn't make sense, but that's kind of an unspoken assumption. And in particular, with values, people think of this as the realm of fables and not finance.
Well, have you made it, Daniel, so that a CFO of a company based on your company, Valuetus, can actually measure the exact financial impact of this? In other words, is that what you do?
Yes. The
Because,
short answer is yes.
every CEO, that's what they want to do. They want to measure the value of values, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what you guys do. Now, you said in your research, you calculated that, and you said this a little bit, but the benefits of acting on these values is 4 to 10 times more than initially believed. Now, if that is true, and I don't disbelieve you, could you share some examples or case studies that illustrated the concept? And that demonstrate that the substantial impact of a values-driven initiative. I mean, I go back to the days of Richard Barrett, and he called it liberating the corporate soul. He used to have that. It wasn't Maslow's chart, but it was kind of like Maslow's chart. It kind of went like this, and then out like this, right? And the reality is, when we could get a company aligned, when I went through all these trainings. In values, right? We got alignment. We would always see enhanced profitability, enhanced productivity, enhanced innovation, enhanced creativity. And you take every area there is, and it was enhanced. But aren't people's personal values frequently not always aligned with what the company's values are? And if they are, aren't, how do you address it?
Yeah, two things. One is that the values that I'm talking about, the ones I talk about in the book, are values around making the world better and improving the lives of those who live in it. Benefiting the world and those who live in it. That's the values I'm talking about. Because there's plenty of good values discussion and thousands of years of books and everything else about personal values. But the thing is that those personal values are not the ones that I talk about because they tend to be more separated from these controversies about what's good for the business, what's the value of the business. Like, if you do something environmentally or socially good, is that good or bad for the business? And that, it turns out, is a different question than, what are people's personal, say, religious values or philosophical values?
Well, let me
Now,
ask you. Sorry, I want to interject here, and I apologize for this, but I'm thinking of Patagonia, and I'm saying, hey, you had Yvon Chouinard, whose values, right? Here's the CEO of Patagonia. whose personal values were very clear to everybody that worked in the organization. And many people were attracted to work there as a result of him carrying the lamplight, right? I'm going to save the world. I'm going to do this differently. And don't you find it important that that CEO truly be the lamplight so that we can carry those values and people can be aligned to take on initiatives? I'm going to say this in particular, initiatives like Patagonia has done to source cottons and materials from the right places to pay people living wages. Doesn't matter if it's tea or it's cotton or whatever it is. I think these are some of the things we're talking about to say, hey, that brings the value of Patagonia up. And that's only one. Zappos, Patagonia, you name it. There's plenty of them, right?
Yeah, and those are in fact the kinds of values that people do join organizations for the benefits of the world, right? So there are some organizations, religious organizations, philosophical organizations, where people join for the personal values. Like, I really like that this person is Christian or Buddhist or what have you. But the things that you're talking about making a difference in the world, really have incredible broad appeal, right? Paying people with living wage. People can see, oh, I understand how that helps me leave a better legacy for the world. And it turns out that doing things like that also help the business. And there are a few different ways, but they basically come down to how do you see, how do you feel, and where do you look? And just as an example of what do you see, IBM had a factory that was making semiconductor chips. And they decided to reduce their water use. Now, this factory had been in operation for a long time. It's a very competitive industry. Obviously, they'd been working on making it more efficient for decades. But nonetheless, as they looked at the water use, they thought, we could do this, we could do that. They cut water use 29%. But number one, that was worth $750,000 a year, which is money that they hadn't seen before. Number two, the non-water savings, productivity, energy use, treatment costs, and so on, were four times as much. And that's what I mean by submerged value. Submerged value was four times as much. And that's why one of the managers there said, when you see the way we see, you don't see water in the pipes, you see dollar signs. That's the connection I'm trying to make with the book.
Well, you are, and you're doing a great job of it. And I want to state that, not every company listening out there today, some do, have chief sustainable officers. And I remember in sustainability, because we're talking about how sustainable is this. And I went to a conference not too long ago where the sustainability officer for Starbucks showed up and spoke. And we heard that Starbucks was going to be requiring more people to come in with their own cups and do things where there wouldn't be this massive amount of pollution or waste as a result of this, right? And there are people inside of companies, and you know this because you work with them, that their job is to find a way to improve the environment and lessen the impact on the globe, and at the same time, give a better customer experience. I have yet to see that at Starbucks, and I'm not pointing out to them, but the reality is that there's an area where the customers that consume their products are probably trying to be pretty environmentally sensitive, you would hope. I wouldn't say that's true all the time, but it is interesting how you're in this conundrum of how do we do this? How do we implement it? And then how do we see the submerged value? Your example about the semiconductors at savings $750,000 in water is a great example. And your book emphasizes the importance of responding smartly and credibly to today's challenges. Plenty of challenges out there. In your view, what are some of the most pressing challenges facing businesses today, and how can leaders leverage the value of values to address them? And it doesn't matter if I'm making tennis shoes at Nike or I'm selling coffee at Starbucks. There's a lot of challenges that they're still faced with.
Yeah, that's very true. And basically, challenges get broken down into a few different areas. One, obviously, is the change in the customer population and expectations. And this is like, do customers care more about the sustainable, responsible choice than they used to? Yes. Even when I've talked to executives who say, yeah, they don't care that much, almost universally they say they're going to care more 3 years from now, more 5 years from now, and so on. And in fact, we've conducted experiments, 500,000 data points across four continents, showing causally that this is the case. Then there's the question of resources. And this is part of, actually, I guess I should say that we have kind of a three-part framework for this. Resources, relationships, and routines are all necessary for a business to succeed, and they're all under different kinds of pressure. Resources are things like, are we able to get the coffee beans we need, to use your example of coffee? Or are we able to get our ships through the Panama Canal for our shipping? Early this year, traffic was down over 20% because of low
Yes.
water. Now, even with the things that they've done to sort of reduce water consumption elsewhere and put water, they're still going to be down 15, 20% of shipping. And then there's also the routines. And this is where, what happens when there's a major disruption in the world, like a ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal, or there's a natural disaster, which is happening more and more often. There's a great article written in Australia called What is a Once in a 100-Year Event and Why Do They Keep Happening So Often? When you have values playing a bigger role in the organization, the Great Places to Work organization found that people are more likely to respond better, respond more productively, and to get through that disruption more successfully. The companies that did worst in the recession, the Great Recession 2007, 2009, had lower scores. And the companies that soared over the recession chasm, as they called it, were the ones that did better at supporting different types of employees that connect to those employee well-being initiatives that leaders have. That's how businesses can respond, is to see the threats to these three different areas: resources, relationships, and routines. And to put values initiatives in place to support those.
You're so true, because it recalls in my mind a social scientist that was on here, and we were talking about many of the same things we're talking about right now. And she is very well known for, I think one of her books was The Bellwether or The Watchtower, whatever it was, but it was about predictive analytics, and part of it about, hey, are insurance companies still going to insure the buildings in South Florida as the waters start to rise? Are insurance companies still going to insure houses in California with the fire risk? We're seeing it being pulled out now right and left in our state, and people up in arms about it. And you're right, it's the ability to, as Rita McGrath said, see around corners. Kind of use these predictive analytics to look at this. And in your case, you can look at this based on predicting this also with the values. And I think the two sciences are really intertwined, most importantly. And I'd like to say you discuss the role of ethics and responsibility in shaping modern business practices. I couldn't agree with you more. The question I always ask, this is just personally sometimes, where do those personal morals and ethics go from some leaders? And I don't know if we pointed this out last time, but one example was the situation with Volkswagen versus the situation with Samsung, right? Volkswagen blew it. Samsung did a great job, had great orders for their phone, even though they were melting afterwards. But how can leaders ensure that the ethical considerations are integrated into every aspect of their organization? Because this is really imperative. If people aren't transparent, aren't open, aren't operating from an ethical foundation, It can really be a catastrophic event for a company.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in fact, Volkswagen shows that quite correctly, because several of their executives went to jail. Their largest dealership in Germany went under because the reduction in the resale value of these vehicles that they lied about was so great that they actually had to declare bankruptcy because the assets that they had weren't worth what they said they were worth, what they expected them to be worth. And of course, there were hundreds of millions of fines and all that other stuff. That's one of the things that has to happen is the bringing in of ethics. And there are two ways. One is, and they're actually both usable by individuals and organizations. The fundamental question is, where do I want to be in the future, and who do I want to be, and what am I not willing to do? Now, for decades, people have said, write your eulogy. What would you want said at your funeral? But it still works. You can actually see when people project themselves 5, 10 years in the future in their career or into the future for their funeral, you can actually see it change the decisions they make today. The second thing is that someone once said to me, what is it that you're not willing to accept? This is a question for both businesses and people. What are the lines they're not willing to cross? Because Volkswagen could not have had that much of a problem if there hadn't been a bunch of people willing to sign off. There's no way one or two engineers could have done that without the knowledge or acceptance or turning a blind eye of everybody else. That's the kind of thing that both individuals and companies can do. Where do I want to be? And who do I want to be? And who am I unwilling to be? And what am I unwilling to do in terms of crossing lines?
Well, that probably brings a very important question that wasn't in our last podcast, but might be to this podcast around the current political structure and situation here in the United States on ethics and values. How is it, from your standpoint, Daniel, that we could have somebody now and why that for many people in this country is totally unethical and doesn't carry any values and run for president again? And this is my show. I can say this. And so the reality is no matter what Mr. Trump thinks, I don't see how people can't see that. I guess maybe I'm coming from a different viewpoint, and I'm not asking you to agree or disagree. I'm looking for a statement from you. Do you believe that this country could be run by somebody in an ethical and moral way, having the values and ethics that he carries?
I think that one of the things that's happening here and around the world is this erosion of trust in institutions and people and in politics. And you have these anti-democratic leaders, these leaders who really are not supportive of democracy. Things like saying the press is the enemy of democracy or the press is the enemy of the people. That's the kind of thing that breaks down the social fabric that we need here. And it's possible for a lot of people to want that kind of candidate. It's always a bit surprising when you see it elsewhere, when you see, Bolsonaro in Brazil, right? Or you see leaders in other places. It's like, well, how does that happen? But the simple fact is that there are people who are attracted to this.
Yeah, they say
Let me show you
disenfranchised
vengeance
people.
or,
Well, they're
yeah.
saying disenfranchised people are the ones that, and that word gets used a ton, but I'm saying there are a lot of people that feel like somebody else did it to them. They're not taking responsibility for their own actions and what happens in their life. And I get that, look, you can blame the government, you can blame your employer, you can blame anybody. But until you step up and take 100% responsibility for yourself, which is where you're coming from with this book, and I'll say that unequivocally, because you don't write a book on values, if you're not really going to look at your own values and the values of the companies that you choose to work for or with. I don't care which one it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you
And
want to
also,
comment on that or?
I think that's right. And I think there are two important things. One is that people underestimate the threat to democracy and how important that is. And companies need to step up and say, you know, disagreement about tax rates, that's part of the process. Disagreement about whether democracy is valuable, that's beyond the pale. And for example, if you do that, you can look back later with pride on what you've done. Here again, an example is IBM. In the 1950s, they wanted to put a new facility in North Carolina. And at the time, North Carolina allowed segregation. Segregation was the law of the land in North Carolina. And they communicated that they weren't going to put the factory there unless it was integrated. And in fact, North Carolina backed down and they had an integrated factory there. In the 100-year anniversary, IBM told their story. And this was one of the things they highlighted. This kind of, you know, we might disagree about this trade policy or this patent policy or whatever. They didn't highlight small disagreements or technical issues like that. They highlighted that they had a strong value, that this value led them to refuse to accept the status in North Carolina. And one of the things that's dangerous is that a lot of companies, A, don't realize the threat to democracy. And democracy is good for capitalism, democracy is good for business. Can you imagine if you had the best product, the best service, the best price, but the contract went to the company that had the best political connections? That would not be America. And
Yeah,
then,
and there's no compromising on this. In other
that's
words,
right.
it
And we
is
need
not something.
courage.
Yeah.
There's a need for companies and individuals to be courageous, to be able to look back and say, you know what? We were courageous and we feel good about it. The way that IBM can look back with pride on its courage in the 50s.
Well, an example, we all can listen to this podcast here being recorded on March 18th and look at Mr. Putin being elected for another 6 years and his only opponent being killed just weeks prior to the election. Kind of not ironic, but you talk about a threat to democracy, it was. So was he. And many of the leaders, as we know, who stood up, and I'm saying leaders, and attempted to make the change. Many are assassinated. Many are no longer with us as a result of the test of power and money. Lots of people with lots of money and lots of people with lots of power do things sometimes that they shouldn't do, and a lot of times they shouldn't do. But that was an offshoot from this interview, but an important one. And your company, ValueTest, you bring a wealth of experience in the measurement and analytics of this and in your book. How does the background in measurement inform an approach or your approach to evaluating the impact of value-driven initiatives? So let's just say XYZ company has an initiative to somehow save energy because they want to make the world a better place. And so they're saying our commitment, I think you could say Amazon is one. They said we're going to have 50% of our vehicles are going to be EVs. Okay. And that's supposed to happen by 2000 and whatever the date is. Well, that's a huge investment. It's a billion, I think, $1 billion commitment to buy all those vehicles, right? Do you think now, as somebody who measures values, that Amazon is taking the right direction and can they measure the return on that investment in so many different ways?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the specifics of Amazon's calculation, but I think that the investment in EVs makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. And when I've seen it evaluated elsewhere, the answer is there's a lot of value because EVs, of course, you're somewhat less exposed to the fluctuations in price of fuel than you are if you're on the market for diesel fuel. In addition to that, EVs tend to have lower cost to operate. Now it depends on the specific EV and so on. But it tends to be lower cost to operate an EV. And of course, there are changes in the context. Like in a lot of places, in Europe, for example, a lot of center cities have either passed or are contemplating banning gasoline-powered vehicles from the center city between certain hours to clear the air and for their citizens' health. An EV protects you against that risk, right? On the one hand, its cost to operate is often lower. On the other hand, it gives you free insurance against these kinds of changes. You don't have to figure out what to do if these things change and suddenly your vehicles are worth less than you thought they were. And it's an example of a tangible commitment that the company makes. The more there's a tangible commitment, the more competitors, customers, and employees can say, you know what? They're not just talking about it because talk is cheap, right? But they're doing something. Now, there's a lot more that could be done, right? The supply chain, the recyclability, the sourcing of the products. A lot of these things are a bigger deal, a much bigger deal in a lot of cases than the last mile delivery fleet. But the idea is not to stop with something visible, but to see what's the most important and to drive that through the business.
Well, it's, you measuring something like that, I think would have a huge impact to create a report for the employees of what EVs have actually done to reduce the pollution, to increase our efficiency, to reduce the impact on the environment, all of the kind of things that you could measure and that you do measure, to actually put that in a report to all the stakeholders inside of a company to really understand that the value of $1 billion investment was going to have a $10 billion return on investment. Because in the end, the CFO is the one who wants to know, hey, if I'm going to put $1 billion out, what do we actually see in return? Now, you have a subtitle on your book that mentions enhancing careers by doing the right thing. How can individuals leverage values-based leadership to advance their own professional growth and development?
Three ways. The first way is they can show their own values on resumes and interviews and so forth. There's evidence that if you put, say, volunteering on your resume, you're more likely to get a call back. The second way is they can search for companies that share their values about doing good for the world and those who live in it, because those companies are better positioned for the future. They're more likely to be successful, they're more likely to stay successful. And you want to be in a good company, one that people really like versus one that has more risk or people don't like as much, even if you decide to leave. The third thing is that leadership matters for careers and values matter for leadership. 2000 years ago, Aristotle talked about the three pillars of persuasion: ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos has the same root as the word ethics. And as a number of people have said, values help attract the best people. And LeVar Burton, the actor, director, and host, said he couldn't follow people who didn't have a shared sense of ethics and weren't authentic to them. And that's true of an awful lot of people.
I remember you said LeVar Burton, right? As you said that, I went right back to roots. So that was a long time ago. And it was interesting, just the night before last, as many of our listeners know, Oprah stepped down from Weight Watchers and came out regarding some drugs that she used to actually advocate for weight loss, and weight loss is a disease. And I was thinking about the controversy, but she did the right thing. She actually took all her shares in Weight Watchers and gifted them to a foundation, So it kind of eased the impact. But when you really looked at her values were right on to do what she did and to come, I would say, clean and transparent about how she lost all of this weight and the fact that There should be no shame or no guilt with that. And I think I hold up people like that who have strong values that are actually doing things in the public eye and are doing them correctly. So very well thought out, very well strategically planned, but and also I would say pretty well executed. Now, your book advises for transformation in how business is conducted. And I think that is a key factor here. That's what I was just saying about Weight Watchers and Oprah. How is the business being conducted? What changes do you hope to see in the business landscape as a result of leaders embracing the values of values? Because this is all about how we do what we do.
I think two things. Number one, more visibility inside business to the importance of values, to all the submerged areas that it matters. And number two, engagement around some of the critical things like the climate, like society, and like democracy. These are areas where businesses need to engage because they're incredibly important. And as the CEO of this leadership magazine said some years ago, in the US, businesses wanted free speech rights, and they got them through court cases. But with rights come responsibilities. That's the way it always has been. And the responsibility is to take the influence, the power, and the capabilities that business have, and to use them to be more successful in a way that's good for the world and those who live in it.
Very well put. Now, to kind of wrap up our podcast today, what message or takeaways do you believe that the readers of your book are going to gain from the values of values? And how do you envision the book making a positive impact on the businesses and the leaders, really, not only just in our country, but worldwide? Because this book is actually going to be bought by everybody in every country, right? And they have to make some decisions. And I think after reading this book and seeing how your company, ValueTest.com, actually measures values and can measure it, and these submerged values, which they literally aren't paying attention to, you shine light on, you hold the lantern up and say, hey, here is something that's very real. It's almost like, Daniel, you are making the invisible visible, right? And you are, because you're measuring something, and that's usually what makes the invisible visible.
Yeah, what I hope that happens is a couple of things. One is that people stop not measuring and not seeing the value. Because as Professor John Sturman at MIT says, if something matters and you don't measure it, you're giving it the only value it can't possibly have, which is zero. And that's why we offer measurement to clients and to customers. But also, people can do this just from the book. There's a whole section about how you can see things out there. They can do this in their own lives. In the book, I retell the story of the boy who cried wolf to talk about the business value of those ethics. And the second thing is that I hope people will be able to combine the things that matter to them personally and their business and work lives. Because we spend a lot of time at work. We spend a lot of time thinking about commuting to and from and getting a job and working in it. That work should be something that we can be proud of inside, something that is making the world better and that is benefiting those who live in it.
Well, I can tell my listeners, and I'm going to hold up the book. We're going to have a link to this. We'll also have a link to the website ValueTest, ValueTus. That is the website for Daniel. Great book. Daniel, you are an honor to interview because you get things so clearly articulated across to the public. Everybody, go out and get a copy of the book. And if you don't buy the book, go to his website. He's got blog entries. It's got all kinds of things that you can read about the importance of this and also how he does what he does. And then pick up the phone, call him, send him an email. It's right there. Contact us to learn more about what he does. Because I guarantee you, the people that listen to this show, the whole concept of your submerged value, Daniel can make that invisible visible for you, and you can really see the value. And if you do have to report to the CFO, I guarantee you there's a measurement as to how much this is going to benefit you and your customers. Thus, thanks for being on Inside Personal Growth, sharing your words of wisdom and your ability to bring that invisible to visibleness.
Thanks, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast on Inside Personal Growth. We appreciate your support. And for more information about new podcasts, please go to insidepersonalgrowth.com or any of your favorite channels to listen to our podcast. Thanks again, and have a wonderful day.